And that's the Kiki music. What does it mean? It means you have once again found yourself at Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And today on the show, we're going to start off with something I know is undoubtedly near and dear to all of your hearts, and that is flashy robot boxing. After that, we have a special installment of the Regrettable Television Pop Quiz, which has a little bit of a twist on it, and we will reveal that in a bit. And then, of course, as always, we're going to talk about what is making us happy this week. So let's start by giving some introductions. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR, if anything?
Ooh. Oh, wow.
kind of felt like a snap. I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR, if anything?
I'm the movies editor at NPR.org.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about a book. I write about a comic book for the NPR website.
Outstanding. Very good. Glenn, I have to ask you a question. Are you a boxer?
I am not.
Do you feel you're the perfect person to review robot boxing?
All right, here it is. I didn't see Real Steel. I didn't see it. And here's my rationale. Look, if there's any movie that seems tailor-made to be seen from the couch on a long gray Sunday afternoon with a frothy beverage or six, it is this film. When you can fast-forward over the adorable Muppet parts and pause on the shirtlessness.
So you're some kind of conscientious objector from Real
Steel. I am. Also, I don't know if I've ever mentioned this to you guys. Every time I see you, and sometimes I occasionally email it to you and tweet about it, but I'm writing a book.
Yeah.
And, you know, we writers of books, well, authors, I think is the term, we can't just be, you know, throwing our time around. We have to prioritize, and the deadline's coming up, and I'm starting to panic. So so I didn't see it, but we do have somebody who's much more qualified than I am.
I don't think of this man as your proxy.
For reasons that will become very clear, he knows more about this kind of thing than I do. He's a pal of mine. He's named Chris Klimek. People who listen to the Film Spotting podcast might have heard him review Captain America for them. He's a music critic for the Washington Post. He's a theater critic for the Washington City Paper, along with our friend Trey Graham. And he's also, among other things, a boxing instructor.
Oh, my goodness. Whose brilliant idea was this to have Chris involved in the show?
He also builds mechanical fighting equipment. He's Hugh Jackman.
He does car repair.
He rehabilitates sad 11-year-olds.
And not for nothing, but we're also upping the ladyliker proportion.
That's right.
Yet again.
What a robust 50% of our on-air cast.
50% girl-likers. Bring it on.
I'm going to tag out, because I hear that's a thing that people do, and tag Chris in.
Thanks for joining us, Chris. You're a boxer, I hear.
Yes. It's very exciting to be here on Talk of the Nation. Thank you. very flattered.
All right. Tell me first, how long have you been boxing?
About 8 years.
Wow. Are you pretty tough?
No. those that can't, how do they finish that adage?
Yeah.
Let's just put it all out on the table here, Chris Klimek. Do you think you could take me in a fight?
That's not the same question as are you tough?
That's not at all the same question, is it?
Oh, my.
See, Chris is remaining silent on this point.
Respectful silence.
Out of respect.
This is Fifth Amendment stuff.
I'm lean, but I'm wiry.
How's your pain revolution? we'll get to that.
Panic shield.
All right, Stephen Thompson, you saw Real Steel.
I did.
What did you think?
I wished I had been drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish there had been more people in the theater, because I saw it on Columbus Day at like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when even I am not drunk. And, but even that tiny little scrappy ragtag band of moviegoers who had amassed in the theater, all like 15 or 20 of us, found ourselves kind of whooping and hollering when the robot boxing happened.
Oh,
and there are many flaws.
Mm-hmm.
In the robot boxing movie.
Mm-hmm.
There is chewy mouthfuls of exposition.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There is a Muppet. There is the the love interest whose job is to maintain an empty gym.
She needs to
save the place through a regimen of not having anybody except Hugh Jackman in there.
Right.
She's
also a robot mechanic, I should point out.
She is a robot mechanic. And
most of the boxing gyms I've ever visited are run by
women who look like Evangeline Lilly.
Waiting for their one client to
yeah.
What I'm trying to get to is the part where the robot boxing is completely awesome, and I kind of love the movie.
So let me just double back, because I kind of have to, because everyone who hears this is going to be having the thought I'm having right now. So what you're saying is you feel the ideal way to see this movie would be with lots of people, mm-hmm. preferably ones who are drunk.
Especially, well, I would also say see it with like a gaggle of your friends. And yes, you said this in your review.
Yes.
I know that's where you're...
I was just going to say, you know, I wrote a review of this movie, and if you had any reason to read it, you might
you would have
known
that
I said that
in
same
fact,
thing.
That is exactly what Linda said.
It's not necessarily that you want to go by yourself, drunk, to a movie theater to see Real Steel.
Because that would be sadly Thompsonian.
if you could, like, yeah, stare into the middle distance and eat an entire bowl of Apple Jacks while watching Real Steel
in the theater.
Yeah. If you smuggle in Chardonnay.
Why don't they sell more Apple Jacks?
They should.
And you have
so you're a pro, baby. Basically,
I am. It's very enthusiastic mm-hmm. about what it is.
Mm-hmm. Trey Graham.
And I should confess that the other week when we did our segment on I Said Good Day, mm-hmm. I was toying with the idea of talking about boxing movies as a thing that I've tried and have no appetite for. I mean, not just Rocky and its spawn, but Raging Bull, which I know is a great piece of filmmaking, but still cannot get enthusiastic about. So I am emphatically not this movie's target audience, mm-hmm. and I enjoyed the heck out of it.
Yeah. It's just it's like lots of robots whomping on each other is kind of my favorite thing about this
movie.
Yeah,
my sister texted me as I was going in. She said she and my nephews had just gone to see it that afternoon. And I said, well, how did it go over with the boys? And she said my 5-year-old nephew was standing up and throwing punches in the theater.
That's two pro.
Yep.
Chris Klimek, are you pro?
I am mildly pro. I mean, for me, this is not going to displace...
It's just too much like your real life.
It is. You know, I need a break from that when I go to... I'm practicing gravity pull upstairs or... No, sorry. Gravity slam downtown.
Oh, I've practiced
all day long.
Upstairs.
What did they call that? It was uptown and downtown.
What is the FCC fine that we need just to incur? I mean, for me, the classic A Boy and His Bot movies are like The Iron Giant
it's a completely different class of movie.
Also, Terminator 2, a little bit. This is not going to displace either of those. As I said when we walked out, the best part was when the robots boxed. Yeah. The tortured father-son dynamic, yeah. You know. I mean, I love Bruce Springsteen. I am, as you like to say on this show, notionally open to fathers and sons with miles and miles of emotional distance between
so
them.
So am I.
Yeah. But, yeah, that was the stuff that didn't work for me. I know, I read your review, and I know you enjoyed the performance of little Fanning Zygote or whatever his name is, as the plucky kid who is right about everything. I think we should discuss this not as a boxing movie, but as a kid's movie. It struck me the more this went on. I think sooner or later, Hugh Jackman has to be right about something. This is a kid's movie in which the 10-year-old is outsmarting the 45-year-old.
Yeah.
Repeating.
Well, they make the 45-year-old pretty damn dumb.
Yeah. Well, and he does sell his child at the beginning of the movie.
Deeply, deeply cynical.
Although he does cut his price from 100 thou to 50 thou after developing principles later
right.
on.
So. Spoiler.
Well, I have
sorry.
To, yeah, yeah, and I have to ask you, Stephen, how surprised were you by the Alexi Murdoch song in the opening?
that song is like 5 years old.
It was very much like you expected, you know, like the last song in the movie to be like Transatlanticism. What it does, opening the movie on, like, wheat fields or whatever, and Alexi Murdoch's Orange Sky, yeah. you know, sort of brutally uh-huh. looming in the background, is it sets the tone that this is a movie that may be about robot boxing, but it's also about the human heart.
Feelings. Now, the other thing that's really funny is that during one of the great robot fights of this movie, I seem to recall we got to the end of it and Chris said... That was curiously involving. Because it's like, you want to not be into it, but it's hard not to be.
Right, no, the fight choreography has come in for a great deal of praise, and I want Chris to talk about
yeah,
this
well,
a little
that,
bit.
Yeah, well, that was Sugar Ray Leonard.
Sugar Ray Leonard, right?
And apparently all that stuff was done before they shot anything with their human actors.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess 2008 or whatever was a very productive year.
But you're gonna agree, I take it, that the fights are
yeah,
well
that, that stuff
well
was great.
I have to say I have reviewed a play in which Chris did the fight choreography for a scene in which a guy had to knock himself out in a single shadow boxing match.
He's like, things
he's
I didn't know.
Boxing with no one, and yeah, it was kind of cool.
Well, I think if I were called upon to do choreography for a fight scene wherein a robot is supposed to get gassed and punch himself out while the other robot is playing possum on the ropes,
I enjoyed the fact that that robot's boxing strategy was very similar to Homer Simpson in his boxing episode.
Well, we enjoyed the fact that you could sort of create a boxing match where you could like use rope-a-dope on, on a robot.
Yes, and before we talk about Sugar Ray Leonard's contribution, mm-hmm. I think, a little more on the rules of this world, like the weight classes of the WRB would have been nice. I'm thinking clearly
you're saying the universe wasn't fully imagined.
That is what I'm saying. This is a movie that has not thought very hard about what life in the future will be like. As we were discussing, other than the clear acrylic cell phones, right. Everything looks pretty hunky-dory.
Right, everything's great.
Actually, this is one of the things I liked about the film, is that the world of the film felt kind of familiar. It's set in the future, but you can see pretty clearly how we get there from here.
Right. But with very little
changes. Yes, which is as soon as we leave this room, right. robot boxing becomes a thing. After Floyd Mayweather refuses to fight Manny Pacquiao and the last interest in genuine organic human boxing fades away. Actually, I was looking for stuff in interviews with Sugar Ray Leonard to try to figure out exactly what he did do on this film to see if maybe he trained Hugh Jackman a little bit. One of the things that, despite everything in the trailer, one made me want to see this is that Hugh Jackman's boxing looks really good. When we see him shadow box, it's clear that he's done the work.
That one scene when he's doing his Eminem in the hoodie and he's by the barn.
I was looking for stuff about Sugar Ray Leonard's contribution, and I came across this video with the director Sean Levy, he of the Night of the Museum franchise.
Seriously.
And Cheaper by the Dozen, I think. Yeah, so he's got some explaining to do.
He and Dennis Dugan probably.
But he says that in the script, the thing that they kind of tease us with in the movie, which is Adam sentient somehow? Is he having a Johnny Five development of a soul there as we look into his deep electronic LED blue eyes?
Yeah.
And in the script, apparently, in that final fight with Midas, the controller breaks or something, and Adam begins to fight on his own. Oh. And Sean Levy says he decided only in the editing suite that took away some of the mystery. And he also liked the idea of having, Hugh Jackman driving Adam.
Right.
When you were mocking, justifiably, the trailer on this show a couple of months ago, I think there was disagreement among the PCAH staff as to whether these were self-directed bots or whether they were being remote-controlled. Which is a question that the movie still does not really answer definitively.
No. Well, it seemed to suggest a world in which some robot boxers are just done with controls, and some are voice-controlled, which seems to me like a very slow and inefficient way to
control. Listeners should
your
know
robot.
That you're doing a little knitting motion with your hands as you're saying that some robot boxers are...
And then some are controlled the way that you might control, for example, a very large Muppet, where you move your body, and because of the way it's attached to you, only this one is kind of like psychically attached to you, it can mimic your movements.
and Adam, is apparently special because he has this now discontinued shadow function, which, as Evangeline Lilly tells us, is very very rare. But I mean that seems like the most sensible way to control a boxing
robot.
If
it's so incredibly awesome and was available way back in 2014, you'd think they'd have advanced on it.
Apple
Newton.
There were some tragic incidents on Christmas morning 2014 when kids unwrapped their new fully body-operated boxing bots that led to the manufacturer to quietly discontinue.
Well, I will say, among the other things I noticed about this movie, I'm just happy that all our future athletic competitions will be held in Bing Arena.
Right. also Star Blaze Arena.
In the future, Bing will take over.
Or, of course, in an abandoned post-apocalyptic zoo.
That Thunderdome setting for the zoo was delightful.
With like all the rugs.
Right, the Road Warrior Methed extras are the crowd there who when Tipper Gore wanted to convince everyone of how frightening heavy metal was in 1986, like these were the extras that she was waving photographs of.
So when we talked a little bit about the fact that there are certain things about the boxing in the movie that are real, And then there are other things about the boxing in the movie that are, for example, panic shield.
Right.
And
so you're talking about in terms of whether it's real boxing.
Exactly.
So
like
this
how
is being
much
addressed.
Real boxing.
So this is being
there?
Addressed. This question is being addressed to Trey.
Right. Yes. Right. Right. Yes. So as I understand it, these little names that they panic shield and whatever the other ones were combinations of moves that were pre-programmed, right?
Yes. And I think there were certain things that they were having the robots do that were like real things. Like when he was first testing out.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, again, the stuff where we see, everybody makes fun of the training montage in this movie, mm-hmm. right? Which, okay, so agreed. The idea that you need to train a robot is maybe no more ridiculous than anything else here, since again, we're established somehow that they need to reprogram Adam so that the montage where he's kind of shadow boxing opposite Hugh Jackman. After we're sort of teased in the beginning with the gravity slam up down, I can't even say that, gravity slam downstairs or whatever the hell it is.
That's a whole different movie. You got to pay extra for that.
Yeah, the pain revolution. Then when we get to the final
pain
fight
with
Midas, the big signature move that Hugh Jackman unleashes is called the Charlie Special. That's really underwhelming. There's a sort of,
it's like you can see the point where they ran out of imagination, right?
After the pain revolution, all is anticlimax.
The Charlie Special. Is that the one where he like jumps in the air?
I wasn't sure if it was referring to that shot that's in the trailer and all the ads, or whether that's just the playing possum.
Yeah.
until the robot gets tired.
Well, they also had the up punching thing.
Right, the double up punching thing, which you never get.
The double double
in the final fight.
Right. Yeah. Which just kept, you know, I guess that makes sense for a robot, but not for a human, where most of the power is coming from your hips, and you can't really turn your hips in both directions at the
same
time.
Tell me more about this power coming.
indeed.
No,
well, the only restriction upon these robots seems to be that they need to all maintain the strategic disadvantage of being humanoid.
Right.
So they're only allowed to have two arms and two legs. And they can't have tank treads or anything.
This is not BattleBots where you I would imagine that there's sort of like where you have extreme wrestling with barbed wire and ladders and fluorescent lights. You would think anything goes, and they should all have like hacksaws.
Yes,
and
if one of the robots had hit the other with a giant robot chair or something, that would have been good. Or a car.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have to say, the popularity of NASCAR is the thing that makes me think that if robot boxing were to be invented, it might be quite popular, right? Because this is
absolutely
a combination of the skill of the driver and the mechanical ingenuity of each custom designed car.
Absolutely.
So it doesn't seem completely ridiculous.
To me, the robot boxing part does not seem terribly far-fetched at all.
I mean, I would watch it.
I would watch it, too. I watched this movie, and I loved it.
All right, this gets to a question that I want Chris to address. I am obviously not ye olde boxing fan. I don't watch it on TV. I don't.
and no one else is either ye olde boxing fan.
What is it? So talk to me about why this is not just about bloodlust.
I've actually thought about this because I'm not a huge sports fan outside of boxing, but I feel like the metaphor of boxing is so simple and so transferable about standing up to, you know, to opposition. It's not the tribal thing or the militaristic thing. I'm not trying to pick any fights with anyone here, but I mean, I think that's why I've never been a big football fan is, you know, because
what?
It all seems, yeah, I mean, it all seems like, a metaphor for warfare, basically, right? Conquering territory, moving the ball into
more than
the
people bonking each other in the head.
Yes, because it's two tribes, it's nations. Whereas boxing is individualistic, and I know it's a cliche, but you're always fighting against yourself. And I know you cited, you know, surely Rocky is the most famous boxing film mm-hmm. ever, but the original Rocky, the good one, what no one remembers about that movie is he doesn't win the fight.
Right,
it's a moral victory. You know, he goes the distance. He convinces himself that he's not a loser. You know, the first hour of that movie, I mean, that's like a mumblecore indie flick in 1976 where he works in a pet store or something and he's trying to get Talia Shire to talk to him, and there's not a lot of boxing in it. It's a very individualistic way to train yourself to not shrink from opposition. You know, you might lose, but you've only lost if you refuse to fight, Trey Grimm.
So what you're saying is that I've lost.
You keep inferring these horribly aggressive things, Stephen.
But here's the thing, though. I do wonder whether the complete absence of actual risk to humans, like whether there would be adequate stakes.
I think flying debris.
But if people...
it seems that there's a lot of risk to the spectators.
But would people really...
They never really acknowledge.
Because the way they say it in the movie is sort of like, well, people couldn't hit each other hard enough, like, to satisfy the fans.
Right.
So they went to robots. But to me, if you go to robots and there's no people and nobody's bleeding...
See, I would have expected...
Then I don't know if anybody's going to want to watch it anymore. Like, who wants to watch robots fight?
See, and they could have just as easily...
I mean, I know you do.
I do. But they could have just as easily explained it away by basically saying, well, a bunch of namby-pambies said that humans aren't allowed to hit each other anymore because of concussions and whatnot.
I would have found that more believable, I guess.
But like, maybe they didn't want to shoehorn in a heavy-handed message
about it just seems to me that what Chris is describing...
I think heavy-handedness and fear there.
That would compromise the subtlety of Real Steel. I agree.
I'm just wondering whether, like, because what Chris is describing is these very high stakes of, like, you having to be going up there and risk your neck. Like, go up there and actually physically put yourself in peril. And I don't know whether it would really work if you were like, well, you're basically my robot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's so much that...
But over there, it's going clang!
And I feel like it's more about the training to the discipline. It's not the 48 minutes if it goes 12 rounds that you're going to be in the ring with the guy. I mean, it's the 6 months prior to that when you're working out three times a day. And I've never done this, I should say. I think that's more what it's about. And I mean, that also seems like the tragedy of it, too. There was a big fight a couple weeks ago when Victor Ortiz fought Floyd Mayweather. And he became frustrated. He headbutted Mayweather in the fourth round. So the ref breaks it up, takes a point from Ortiz, and then they shake hands, touch gloves. And then Ortiz, who has already hugged Mayweather in apology, tries to hug him again, but... You know, it's time in, and Mayweather hit him with a left hook, a right cross, and knocked him out. And I mean, that
That's
was just
horrible.
Bizarre.
Punished
that was just
for hugging.
Yeah. So it's well, there's some question about it. Again, he had already hugged Mayweather, but after that, then he also kissed him on the cheek. So there's some debate over whether he was being deliberately provocative or whether that was further apology.
It's not like a Godfather thing.
I was gonna say how mafia.
Yes. They kiss on the lips, and that's the last kiss you ever gonna get when Michael Corleone kisses you. That kind of psychodrama of saying what was in Victor Ortiz's head would not be a factor in robot boxing. So that's what you would lose.
Chris, if you were an eccentric billionaire, would you hire Evangeline Lilly to stare at you dewy-eyed as you went about your daily life?
I think I would wage a nocturnal one-man war on crime. although I would certainly try to find some way to fit Evangeline Lilly in.
Well, and I like the fact very much that she seems to be a robot mechanic, both mostly because someone has to explain the robot mechanics. Like, mostly she runs the gym, but then all of a sudden
mostly she stares approvingly.
But then she's like, oh, also I know all about robots, so she can be like, well, this one is the blah blah blah, and it's got this ability. And it's
she herself
ability.
Is sort of like the exposition robot.
She is.
Right. Well, the only one who doesn't seem to know about that stuff is Hugh Jackman.
Yeah. the guy who's in the actual business of doing it.
Whose kid has to explain to him that, well, it's a Japanese robot, so the default language setting is Japanese. Bad.
Good robot movie. Good robot movie. So, thank you, Chris, for dropping by to discuss this movie with us.
Oh, thank you. This was fun.
We will we'll borrow you again briefly at the end of the show. And until then, we're going to bring back Glenn Weldon for our next segment. Tag back in Glenn Weldon.
Now, our second segment is all about boxing robots.
We are returning to one of our favorite segments, the Regrettable Television Pop Quiz. But we are going to do a little bit of a variation on the theme, which is we thought that rather than focusing on the regrettable television of right now, we would open ourselves up to the regrettable television of the past. So we have each provided a regrettable piece of television, and we're going to listen to some clips, and we're going to see what we can figure out. Mike Katz, if you want to cue up a piece of regrettable television for us.
I'm going to ask you a question.
What?
I thought your job was arresting criminals.
Sir.
What you're supposed to be doing is protecting us from them, not treating us like them.
You see this white collar? I'm easy to spot. I'm into the powder, but I don't do a lot. It's not like I'm homeless or strung out on crack. With the taxes I pay, you should cut me some slack. But don't mess with my pursuit of happiness.
Wow.
course, we all know exactly what this is.
I can give you the year. synthesizers.
Well, yes.
It's like 1985.
But it's a little later than that.
It's cop rock, right?
Yeah, it's cop rock.
Oh, cop rock.
The musical Stephen Bochco police drama that
lasted
aired
about
11
episodes.
How did it last three
or four before they announced the cancellation, but they actually aired 11 episodes.
They didn't used to pull things quite so far.
I was going to say, that would be a good trivia question. How long did cop rock last? Because I would have been sure it was three or four.
That song is a bunch of Wall Street types getting busted in a cocaine sting, and they all break out in song complaining about how they're contributing to the economy and shouldn't the cops be harassing some homeless people. Seriously, there's a lyric in that bit that ends with, "I want my Beamer back."
Of course there is. That is a great pick.
I actually have one more clip that I want to play for you, Ed, because I want to talk about what I think doomed this show.
I can name a couple already, dude.
I can't imagine what.
And you foot patrols, keep a lookout for that supermarket Robin Hood. He been stealing from the stores and giving to the poor. He's the hero of the neighborhood.
Is it the terrible music?
Dr. Zaius.
This is a straight up lift from Hill Street Blues, right? It's the duty sergeant sending the beat cops out with their morning assignments, and the song is called Be Careful Out There. And it is fascinating to watch this clip on YouTube.
Fascinating, is it really?
No, it really, really is. If you watch it and remember that it's 1990, and then you imagine what this would be like today, the camera work and the musical staging in this thing is so dull. It's 2.5 minutes long, and the sergeant just stands at the front of the briefing room singing at the cops. If this were on Glee, you'd have had the cops up and dancing and wearing some sort of sequin Chippendales cop outfit. By the end of the first
Trey's
chorus.
Like, well, that's how I see it.
There was a kind of commitment to realism most of the time on this show that was so at odds with the kind of formal experimentation that he was trying, which is not something that had never been done before. Uh-huh. He wrote and talked and was interviewed a lot about how his inspiration for this were things like The Singing Detective, which was successful both commercially and artistically. It seemed to not understand how its impulses were clashing in ways that strike you as really surprising now.
And that is why we at Pop Culture Happy Hour bring you Why Didn't Cop Rock Do Better back in 1990? That's our question of the week. Well, that is an excellent choice, Trey Graham, and I very much enjoyed your choice. Mike Katzeff, hit us again.
Now it's time for me to choose one of you for my first date. I'm a bit shy, so I'm going to have to whisper to my friend the name of the guy. Okay.
Anna had told the sea lion who she had picked to go on the special date.
It's Average Jane or something.
Average Joe.
Is it Average Joe? It's Average Joe. Yeah.
I love the incredible build up to.
Yeah, it's Average Joe. I got confused because there was one with a woman, but yes, that would naturally be Average Joe.
And was that the fake one?
No.
Average Joe was quite real.
There were three very real seasons. In a different season of Average Joe, the giant twist at the end is that the dudes who are remaining find out that the woman, the object of their desire, had once dated Fabio. And they treat this as if she has, like, syphilis and a third ear.
Well, to be fair.
They have this revelation. It's like, she has a terrible secret. And it turns out to be, I dated Fabio. It's the most bizarre, really crazy.
So yes, Average Joe, which manages to incite the all the horrible feelings that you have when you were a nerd, while in the context of watching an incredibly idiotic dating show.
Yeah, it doesn't sound very good.
But the sea lion picks well.
Yeah. The sea lion
goes from dude to dude, like roaring at them, until it finally stops at one and emits this hideous grin.
Yeah.
It's awesome. It's even better seen than heard.
Mm. Well,
I'm a little unclear on exactly what the sea lion's function is here.
The sea lion, that's
randomly choosing a guy.
I would assume the producers trained the sea lion to pick. It's not who she like picks in the end. It's who she picks to go on this particular date.
Yeah.
Come on, the stakes aren't that high.
Yeah. So Average Joe, a show that we are all perfectly happy to leave in the past.
Yes.
Along with Cop Rock. Mike Katzen.
I mean, come on now, guys. I've been a real good sport about this whole thing. Now, I've done exactly as you asked me to do, against my better judgment.
Yes, you have served your purpose. Centauri?
Oh, now, hey, wait a minute now, big fella. No reason to get uptight. I mean, I believe in live and let live. I mean, if you and your friend want to look at the stars, you know, and you want to communicate with your brothers or whatever it is, who's to say what's normal? You know what I mean? I mean...
Centauri!
Stop them, Centauri!
Get out of the way!
You don't have to say it twice.
Wolfman Jack versus Flash Gordon.
There are three huge hints in that. The first one
Centauri.
Is that whoa sound. The second one is the word Centauri. The third is Wolfman Jack. So
it really is Wolfman Jack?
It's really
hey,
Wolfman Jack.
Daddy-o.
We had a cartoon series for a while, right?
Nope.
I have no idea. I really think it's Wolfman Jack versus Flash Gordon.
Nope. It's very close, though. It is Galactica 1980.
How did I not get that?
Battlestar Galactica only lasted one season. I didn't realize that. But when it went off the air, there was a letter-writing campaign. It was one of the first ones that was actually successful. But the network said, we'll bring the show back if you slice the budget, decimate the budget.
Right.
So they...
So it's finger puppets?
It's... Well, looking back, you might think that Battlestar Galactica was like... grand space opera, but it was actually always more space community theater. It was really cheap, but even then they had to get rid of all the sets, the costumes. They had to fire most of the cast, and they said it. This is actually genius. They said it a generation after the events of the original series, so that they could land on modern day 1980, modern day Earth, and therefore use the same backlots that everybody else was using in 1980. Use the same Laurel Canyon locations that everybody else was using. So it's set in disco era LA.
What do they call this place? Pasadena.
That's right. It was placed in the Sunday night at 7 o'clock time slot, opposite Wonderful World of Disney and a little show that didn't really ever go anywhere called 60 Minutes.
Oh, yeah.
So it was not a ratings juggernaut.
Yeah.
But by FCC rules, it was considered a children's show all of a sudden. It went from being a sci-fi show to a children's show, which means it had to have lots of kids, and it had to stop its action, and I'm using the term loosely, had to stop the action dead every quarter, every act break, to do what they called an educational beat, which means the characters had to explain to the audience something like how the plants grow or how a television camera works. Absolutely true. So all these clips are available on YouTube. You can go and look through them. There was also, of course, they needed to put some kids in there, so they invented the Super Scouts. The Super Scouts were these adorable Muppets, space Muppets.
I love how it's like CanCon, but for kids.
It's exactly right, because they came down, they were all wearing identical uniforms and little red berets, and their job was to blend in with Earth culture, which was difficult. A, because they were wearing little red berets, and B, because they all had, any guesses? It's right there in the name, Super Scouts.
Mumps.
Cookies?
Superpowers, guys.
Had
superpowers. So, I mean, it's difficult to convey how weird this show was. In that clip you heard, Cylons land right next to the 405. They get into a car on Halloween night with William Daniels as a clown.
Of course.
You can see the mustache.
And they get stuck in traffic.
They go to this, they're a swinging 80s couple. They go to a swinging 80s party. They meet Wolfman Jack, and then the Cylons force him to take him to the radio station so they can radio the Cylon fleet. In the original series, the two hot hunky male leads were named Starbuck and Apollo.
Yes.
Which kind of gives you this idea of this is a science fiction show.
Right.
In Galactica 1980, the two hot hunky male leads were named Troy and Dylan. So that pretty much kind of gives you...
Hyven!
Watch out for Brianna and Brittany and Cody and Taylor. So anyway...
It sounds like Galactica 90210.
There was a Western episode where called Space Croppers, where the gang helps out some migrant farm workers in Oxnard, let's say. There was a Bad News Bears episode called Spaceball, where the Super
now you're
Scouts...
just making this...
No. All on YouTube. Check it out. Where the Super Scouts join Little League to save, the rec center. I'm just going to go out on a limb here. I didn't actually watch the damn thing, but I'm going to guess that there's a rec center involved. There's usually a rec center involved.
Yeah.
You can find it on DVD. You can watch them on YouTube, but don't.
Yeah. Excellent choice. All right. Final round of Regrettable Television Pop Quiz Vintage.
Okay. you have a favorite record. And one day, you find a scratch in the record. And although you have no proof, you're pretty sure that one of the kids in the house did it. What course of action do you take?
Well, I would ask the kids if they scratched the record.
And if they say they did?
I would be shocked, because I never admitted to anything like that when I was a kid either.
Oh, sorry, Megan.
Wrong answer?
No, right answer.
Then what are you sorry about, Charles?
Well, you see, you've passed the interview, and now I have to put you through the torture test.
All right.
That is some genius comedy.
It is,
as
it
you
is.
Can imagine.
Pauses in that Charles in Charge.
Wow. Charles in Charge.
New boy in the neighborhood lives downstairs, and it's understood. He's there just to take good care of me, like he's one of the family. Charles in charge of our days and our nights. Charles in charge of our
wow.
days.
Have you never heard this?
It's not been a long time.
This is, you can't fully appreciate this show without it. Because the little harmony. Yeah.
Ooh.
There's a lot going on there. Yeah, it's awesome.
Wow.
Yeah, so it is Charles in charge. But that's not the beauty part. The
no,
beauty part
the
is
the devil you say.
No. No, it is of course Scott Baio, Charles in Charge. But the beauty part is who the girl is. Did you hear the girl?
I did.
That he was talking to?
Yeah.
Did she sound familiar?
A little bit.
You know who the girl was? Charles in Charge?
Don't know.
That would be Miss Meg Ryan.
Wow.
In a very early television appearance as
my
the
goodness.
Random pretty young blonde on Charles in Charge. Now, the thing about Charles in Charge, my favorite piece of trivia about this show, and I do have one, is that this is a show where after one season, they replaced everyone except Charles, and of course, his friend Buddy, Willie Ames, because, you know, that's the heart of the
show.
Well,
when you got an Ames.
Exactly.
You
know. They replaced the whole family. They had the existing family and all the kids move out, and a new family moved in, and they just replaced, like, the whole cast. And you can't really do that anymore. Like, if you imagine people being like, we're keeping the show on, but we're just replacing the whole cast, people would be like, what is with your desperation here?
Right.
Here Galactica 1980, this thing.
Exactly. Here it was fine. Here it was like, oh, we'll just throw out the old family and get a new family. And I greatly preferred the original family. So I was very unhappy because then it was just blonde girls. Whereas
you've never really recovered.
Correct. And the original family was more like smart alecky brunettes, whereas the new family was all like pretty cute blondes, including whoever that Eggers girl is who went on to be on Baywatch. And I was like, this is not cool. This is not good.
Eggers girl.
They got rid of all the smart alecky brunettes and replaced them with pretty blondes.
So it didn't speak to you.
Didn't speak to me. Once you get rid of the smart Alex, it does not speak to me anymore. So that is my pick, Charles in Charge.
Excellent. Good one.
And I strongly recommend listening to the theme song as many times as you possibly can. And of course, naturally, that brings us to our final segment, what is making us happy this week? So, Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
What is making me happy this week is a new product.
Is it for your hair?
It makes my
Is
hair
it for polishing your
makes
Emmy.
Makes my hair 15% more lustrous. No, I have not yet acquired it, but now that I know of it, I feel like the universe is just a slightly better place. It is called the iCade. Have any of you heard of the iCade?
No.
The iCade is a wooden box into which one inserts one's iPad and converts it into an arcade machine. And there are emulators for Donkey Kong and any number of machines that I would otherwise be, you know, as I've mentioned on this podcast, I bought a Zaxxon machine a few...
Did a guy offer to sell you one of these out of the back of a van and just sold you a big wooden box and...
They sell them on Amazon, thank you very much. I have not yet purchased one, but I've just learned of its existence, the iCade. Now, you know, my kids have an iPad, no longer. Now it is mine.
Right.
And that is what is
that
making
That is yours
happy.
For the purpose of arcade games, and that is what is making you happy. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Three quick examples of folks picking at the low-hanging fruit that is NPR humor. First one was from last week's Parks and Recreation. Yes. Leslie Knope goes on a local NPR radio station. The joke there that I came away with was Nefertiti's Fjord, mm-hmm. and Afro-Norwegian acoustic funk. Now, whenever I make fun of NPR, I always go to the tube and throat singing, and I think I'm going to start working this into the rotation. I like the idea of Africa, Afro-Norwegian acoustic.
I used to do Balinese bongo jams.
There you go. The Ira Glass sex tape, relax ladies and 3-5% of the men. It's not what you're thinking. It's a gag. It's like a 11-minute video on YouTube that kind of purports to be what an Ira Glass sound-alike does. He kind of puts in clips from Terry Gross, and they do a little back and forth. It's cute. At 11 minutes, it's a little long, but it's fun. But the thing I really want to talk about is a podcast, which I just learned about this week, but I should have known for a long time. It's called This American Wife. You see what they're going for there. It's a gentle parody of the NPR approach, sort of making fun of This American Life, making fun of All Things Considered in particular. But it's essentially an interview show. And the reason I got turned onto it is they were interviewing people from the Thrilling Adventure Hour, Super Ego, and some Twitter folks that I really like, Shelby Farrow, Allison Agosti, and other people. The host assumes a sort of breathy, credulous NPR persona. He'll say things like, "We can assume that at one point you were a child. Tell us about that." So that's the joke. He also pretends at some occasions to not own a television, which is crazy, right? The idea of an NPR host who doesn't look down a television? Uh-huh. That's crazy. But he occasionally gets a little bit more pointed, as when he busts out an un-freaking canny Robert Siegel impersonation.
Wow.
So, Robert, where do you see your career going?
Well, Dave, there's really nowhere else that this thing could go. The ship is off the pier. There's no going forward. We've come to the end of a long journey for me.
If a ship is off the pier, it would be going forward.
Call me the Commodore, but this ship is going where I say it's going. And I will not have back talk or sassing on my boats.
Okay, but you are on my show. This is A Drink with Dave. We're happy to have you. We're thrilled to have you. It's been really an honor. The last few hours have been fantastic.
Thank you. Now, I have to ask you, is this show called A Drink with Dave, or is it called 12 Drinks with Dave? Because I'm on the latter show.
Okay. So that was a bit that they did. He had Dave Holmes on the show, and they did a little bit in the middle where they kind of switched it as if Dave Holmes was interviewing Robert Siegel on his show, A Drink with Dave. So on the back of this guy's headshot, right, there's like special skills, horseback riding,
right,
can juggle,
right,
uncanny Robert Siegel.
That's a very good Robert Siegel.
It has many fine qualities.
I will say that on the music team, we have been known to write short scripted, what we call back announces, where mm-hmm. they call back to the website. And we like to try to put funny phrases in Robert Siegel's mouth. And Franny Kelly once got him to say, "Take the party outside." I do not do a good Robert Siegel. I managed to get him to read a string of Andrew W.K. song titles. So I got to get Robert Siegel to say, "Party till you puke."
There you go.
That was what was making me happy that week.
So that is called This American Wife. It's a lot of fun.
Very, very good. Trey Graham, what is making you happy this week?
I've got very little to complain about in general, so my level of happiness is high across the board. I'm just going to single out one little thing, which is that Dexter is back.
Oh, nice.
Dexter, my favorite bloody, gory, twisted Showtime series, is back. And I'm going to cede the rest of my time to our guest, I think.
Very, very good. We did want to hear what is making Chris Klimek happy this week.
Speaking of hunky serial killers.
So, Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
Okay, I have two things, both boxing related. The first is that HBO Boxing After Dark is coming back to DC for the first time.
Boxing After Dark?
Yes. In 18 years. It was announced this week that Amir Khan, a British junior welterweight champion, is going to fight DC native Lamont Peterson just across 7th Street from where we're recording this in the Washington Convention Center on December 10th. Like I said, HBO.
When you said it was going to happen just across the street, I was like, what, at the 6th and I Historic Synagogue?
Yes, where I saw Laura Marling last week. Like I said, this is the first time HBO has come down and covered a fight in D.C. Since a Riddick Bowe fight in 1993. So if you live in D.C. and you like boxing, that's a big deal. But what's really making me happy this week is a story that Linda may have heard of, because I know you watch ESPN. Mm-hmm. But this was in today's New York Times. On Saturday, Bernard Hopkins is fighting in Los Angeles. I am more interested in the undercard of that fight, which will include the professional debut of 52-year-old Dewey Bozella. This is a great story because it was only 2 years ago that Dewey was released from prison after spending more than half his life in jail on a false murder charge. He was convicted when he was, I think, about 24 of killing a 92-year-old woman in her home. The details of his false conviction, I mean, you've heard the story a tragic number of times, you know, convicted on the hearsay of two witnesses who were given deals, physical evidence linking another man to the crime, all that stuff. In 1990, when he was still a young man, although he'd been locked up for 6 years. He was retried. The prosecution told him at that time, hey, look, just admit you did it and we'll let you out. And he said, I can't. I didn't do it. It takes him another 19 years after that to be released from prison. But while he was in jail, he started boxing. I'm sure these are not all he accomplished. In fact, he managed to woo a woman via correspondence and marry her while in prison. But he earned a master's degree from the New York Theological Seminary, and also started boxing.
Jeez.
Little fun cinematic detail there. The boxing ring at Sing Sing is in the death house on the same piece of concrete where the electric chair once stood there. Yeah, so anyway, he finally gets out 2 years ago, starts counseling ex-cons and teaching in a boxing gym. It's 2009. The fiscal crisis is upon us, so that boxing gym closes.
Evangeline Lilly couldn't save it.
Despite her...
How is this not a movie already?
Her best... Well, it's a better movie than Real Steel, for
sure.
It
will be a movie.
So when ESPN chose him to receive their Arthur Ashe Courage Award, an award they've previously given to Muhammad Ali, Nelson Mandela, Pat Tillman, the former football player turned Special Forces soldier killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan, he was offered a professional fight after that. So at 52, he is believed to be the oldest fighter ever licensed by the California State Athletic Commission. He failed his first physical to get that license on August 24th, retook the test after losing 10 pounds and training harder a month later, and passed this time. The day after he is granted his boxing license, a federal judge throws out his wrongful conviction suit against the city of Poughkeepsie, New York. Anyway, he says his professional debut on Saturday, the day after this will post, will be his first and only fight. And he is, it's a purse in the low four figures, so the money is not going to change anybody's life. He says he is fighting to prove a point to himself, just like Rocky.
Speaking of triumphs of the human spirit and the happiness of others, what is making me happy this week is that I watched over the weekend a documentary called Bill Cunningham, New York. Bill Cunningham is like 80-something years old now, and he photographs fashion for the New York Times. So he does several different things. He goes to high society parties where when he is working, not only does he not like eat the dinner at the fancy party or have a drink, he will not accept a glass of water because he feels that I'm working and I'm not partaking of the party. So he will not let them bring him a glass, so much as a glass of water. He does runway shows. He goes to the big runway shows and photographs those. The thing that's really great about him is he goes out on his bike in the street in New York and just takes pictures of fashion, real fashion, what people are actually wearing, and they run them in the New York Times as these really cool photo montages where he'll go out and one day it'll be like all boots and shoes and another day it'll be all like skirts and legs. And he is an extremely sort of odd, unusual old man. He is also fascinating and wonderful and incredibly kind-hearted. He has been single all his life. He says he's never had a romantic relationship, but he's extremely happy. He has wonderful friends. When they ask him whether he's ever had a romantic relationship, he's basically like, I have no time. I love what I do so much. This is what I do, and I'm completely happy. They adore him at the Times. You know, he's a hero at the Times. He is someone who Anna Wintour in this documentary basically sits and genuinely gushes about how much she loves him and what an amazing person she thinks he is. And there's footage of her arriving at an event and he's there in his blue windbreaker that he wears to everything. And he says, oh, Anna. And she turns around. She poses and poses and poses and poses and poses. And then she walks into this event and there are a gazillion photographers like, Anna, Anna, Anna. She ignores everybody and goes right into the event. But for him, if he's there, she stops every single time. She says he's been taking her pictures since she was 19 or 20 years old when she was just kind of this young woman interested in fashion out in the city. And it is such a cool documentary. And what it made me think about is it's so sad that so many documentaries are so sort of important and heavy and dire that I think a lot of times people forget that they can also be just really entertaining, fun movies. So there are elements of sadness and seriousness and contemplation, but a lot of it is just this really cool documentary about this like 80-year-old dude zipping around New York on his bike. He says it's something like his 27th bike and he's had 26 stolen. He just basically gets a new one when they get stolen and he locks it up, but you know, so it's just important to keep in mind that when you see a documentary that's widely praised, don't assume that it's going to be a slog. And I have admired many documentaries that are painful slogs. But many of the ones that I really love are genuinely fun, uplifting, warm-hearted films, and this is one of them, and it's called Bill Cunningham, New York.
Yeah, this fits in, right in that sweet spot with things like the crossword puzzle, you know, documentary and the Spelling Bee documentary.
And it's also a great thing about fashion and about new media. Bill Cunningham, New York. It's on Netflix streaming. Strongly recommended. It made me very happy this week. It was part of my Stay in Bed Saturday, which I have talked about before on this show. It was part of Stay in Bed Saturday. And that brings us to the end of our show for this week. And you can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham, exactly like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our esteemed producer, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. My guess is you can follow Chris on Twitter. Is that true?
That is true. It's C-T Klimek, C-T-K-L-I-M-E-K. Like the cracker.
Chris Klimek, good to follow on Twitter. I follow myself and have for quite some time. You'll see his little Superman avatar. You can also follow us. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. So thanks to all of you for being here to have this little chat.
You bet.
Thank you. And now I follow Chris on Twitter.
Aww.
Well, good. Next time I need to beg a ride from NPR staff home from a Wilco concert, I will be the beneficiary of you following me, I hope.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.